From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the numbers just keep going up. Now nearly 60,000 cases of COVID-19 have been reported worldwide. At least 1,300 have died. But researchers are still trying to pin down exactly how it began infecting people. Peter Daszak is a disease ecologist and president of EcoHealth Alliance. He's just back from a World Health Organization meeting in Geneva and joins us now. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
And I understand that this meeting you were just at in Geneva focused on the origins of the virus. What do we know so far about where this virus might have come from?
Well, it's still not totally clear. I mean, obviously there was involvement of a wildlife market, a market that sold various animals. And that's happened before. We saw that with SARS. But the first few cases actually didn't report being at the market. So there's some lack of clarity there. I think we need to do a lot more digging to find out where it originated.
Scientists in China have proposed the idea that the endangered pangolin might have passed the virus from bats to humans. How likely is that?
Well, it's possible that pangolins got the virus from a bat. That's possible, and especially in a market. But the real problem with that idea is that there are just so few pangolins in markets. Yes, it's the world's most widely trafficked animal, but usually people sell scales. They actually kill the animals, take the keratinaceous scales off them and sell them as a medicinal product, not live animals. So a dead scale off the surface of an animal is unlikely to spread a virus. So, you know, jury's out. We don't know. It's quite possible some other animal acted as an intermediate to get the virus from bats into people.
And how does that work exactly?
Well, the thing about our sort of exposure to bats, there is a lot of it out there. You know, bats are very common, very diverse in southern China, across Southeast Asia. But in the wildlife markets, they're quite rare. So it's possible that a bat went into a farm where people were farming civets, porcupines, pigs, or some other animal that could be receptive to the virus. And then the virus would replicate in those animals and build up enough quantities to start infecting people. And you could imagine someone selling those animals to a market and spreading that virus across the interface between animals and people. That's a valid scenario. Pangolins could have played a role in that for sure, but we just don't know yet.
Well, and when it goes from an animal to a person, is that through the air?
Well, in bats, these viruses tend to be gut infections. So it would be fecal contamination or maybe saliva. In the wild situation, you'd be contaminated by bat feces. But if a bat is being killed for food, then you've got much more chance of getting contaminated because you're cutting it. There may be blood exposure. There may be intestinal and all the other organs. And people do eat bats across southern China and Southeast Asia. It's quite common, actually.
How do scientists like you trace back the path of a virus like this one and figure out its origins for sure?
Well, there's a few different things we look at. And one is the actual virus itself. You can look at the genetic sequence of the virus and say, what is it most closely related to? Is it related to, in this case, it is a cluster of other bat origin viruses? And then you've got to get on the ground and do a lot of work, a lot of interviewing people, asking them about the habits, going to farms, going to bat caves, sampling, and taking those samples and testing them to see which animals actually carry these viruses as a normal part of their life. And what we've found is that bats are the main reservoir for these coronaviruses. We found over 500 new coronaviruses in southern China in the last 10 years or so, and about 50 closely related to SARS. So there's a clear and present danger from our contact with wildlife. And if that contact is expanding, and especially through things like the wildlife trade, it's bringing us a risk of these pandemics for sure.
And why is it so important in the middle of a crisis like we have right now, when people are trying to figure out how to treat this, when people are trying to figure out how to quarantine people or not quarantine people who may or may not have it, why is it so important for people like you to try to figure out the origins of it?
Yeah, good question. Look, I mean, it's not some scientific interesting thing we're going to find out. This is actually valuable to public health. If there's an animal involved that isn't a bat, that's some sort of farmed animal, even if we clear up the infection in people, those animals could still be passing on infection to new cases somewhere out there in rural China. If we don't know where that is, it's going to be really difficult to stamp out this outbreak ultimately. So it is a value to public health.
How long do you think it's going to take to figure out the origins?
Well, it could take a few weeks. We may know more every week. We'll find some new information, I'm sure. But ultimately, to really find out what happened, it's going to take a couple of years. But what I think there's going to be a concerted effort to do right now is find out if there's an intermediate host, if there are livestock somewhere in southern China that have the virus and could be infected and passing on the virus. And hopefully that's going to take a few weeks to clear up.
That is disease ecologist Peter Daszak, who is president of Eco Health Alliance. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Well, we're getting more reaction today to Attorney General William Barr intervening in the case of President Trump's longtime friend Roger Stone, calling for a shorter sentence than his prosecutors recommended after tweets from the president that the department says had nothing to do with the intervention. Stone had been convicted for lying to Congress, among other things. There's also more reporting today on President Trump's withdrawal of the Treasury Department nomination of Jesse Liu, who supervised the Stone case. John Dowd, a former Justice Department attorney who's represented Trump, told Politico Trump and Barr did nothing wrong. Charles Fried, former Solicitor General under President Reagan and a professor at Harvard Law, says Barr did nothing illegal. But, Professor, your reaction when you heard the story?
It was dismaying, but not surprising. Bill Barr is not an honorable man, and he is totally corrupted by his position working for Donald Trump.
Well, I'm going to have to hold you up there because these are quite, you know, the charges. And as you well know, William Barr, when he was in the Bush administration, when he was asked about firewalls between the Justice Department and the White House, he said, yes, there is a firewall and it has to be honored. So at least at one time he had said that. And his agency says this intervention had nothing to do with the president's tweets. Your thoughts?
I don't believe it for a minute.
Okay, so you say that this is horrible. What else is it? Because
what it is, it's horrible because the sentencing guidelines are really quite precise. They take account of all kinds of factors. And you didn't mention that Stone threatened one of the witnesses and even threatened the judge. So that will up the ante. Now, 7 to 9 years is a very harsh sentence, particularly for a man of 67. But this is not out of line with the general rules. That's the point of the guidelines.
Well, former Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy said on Fox News that there are child pornographers who don't get 9 years. But even if you disagree with the length of the recommendation, weren't there other avenues?
Well, the prosecutors don't do the sentencing. The judge does. Judges often either lower the recommendation, sometimes they increase it.
Are you watching other action coming from this Department of Justice? We mentioned Jesse Liu's Treasury nomination. It was withdrawn. She was a Trump appointee. She was overseeing these prosecutors and also overseeing the investigation into Andrew McCabe, the former acting FBI director who's been accused of lying to investigators. Some fear that her being pulled off that case means that it, you know, will now be intervened with, as was the Stone case. And NBC is reporting that senior officials at the Justice Department intervened last month to reduce the sentencing recommendation for President Trump's former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, who's pled guilty to lying to the FBI. Are you seeing a bigger picture here?
Yes, we have a bigger picture in which the president does not hesitate for a moment to break the rules and help his friends and hurt his enemies.
Look, what do you think should happen here? Nancy Pelosi, in her press conference today, said that this was abuse of power, words that send chills through a lot of people because does that mean another impeachment? What are your thoughts?
Well, let's see what the judge does. The judge is a very able person and will make her own judgment.
Attorney General Barr has also agreed to testify in front of the House Judiciary Committee, but that won't be till March. He'll surely be asked about this. What questions do you have?
I don't have any questions. It's so obvious what happened. Look, Stone is an admitted, convicted liar. He's a trickster. He's a absurdly, almost comically vain man. And so when Trump looks at him, he sees himself.
Charles Fried, again, former Solicitor General under President Reagan, we can't make assumptions, but I'm wondering if you are a Republican and if you are wondering what this has done, will do, is doing to the legacy of your party.
Well, it's corrupting it. I refuse to drop the name of Republican. I won't allow myself to be demeaned by having him control what I am.
Charles Fried, former Solicitor General under President Reagan, professor of law at Harvard. Charles, professor, thank you.
Right. Goodbye.
Finding love at work can be exciting, but mixing the personal and professional can be high risk. This week, NPR's Life Kit is talking tips for love in the workplace. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
Let's get back to our conversation with Brian Chesky, co-founder and CEO of Airbnb. We talked about the company's coming IPO, as well as criticism that Airbnb is driving up the cost of living. But there's also the news from last year that five people died in a shooting at a house party at an Airbnb in California. I asked Brian Chesky how much responsibility he takes for vetting hosts and guests at the millions of Airbnb listings all over the world.
On Halloween, a tragedy struck when there was a shooting. Five people were killed. And in the aftermath of that situation, we decided that we were going to be extremely bold in our response. And so what we did is we announced a handful of things. Probably the most significant of those are that we intend to verify every single listing on Airbnb. We want to verify the identity of both the host and the guest. We want to verify the listing. And by verify the listing, we want to verify its accuracy and that it offers what people say it offers. And we want to continue to increase the veracity of what is on our platform.
How do you verify every single listing, though? That's a lot of listings.
Oh, yes, it is. And I think the key thing here is very few internet companies have attempted to verify the information on their platform. And so I think this is a fairly important move that we're making. Now, how do we do it? Well, the most important thing we're going to leverage is our guest community. Over 70% of our guests who stay in homes, and there's over 2 million a night, by the way, leave a review after they check out of their Airbnb, 70%. In those reviews, we can ask them a variety of questions. And if we get enough reviews, we can have a pretty high confidence in what that information is. That's probably the most important. But we are also building an entire team of people that can do remote inspections. People can submit information. So there's kind of a plethora of ways we're going to verify listings so that we can stand behind it. And no other company in travel is doing this for people sharing their homes. So this would be an industry first for travel. But more broadly than that, tech companies are shifting from being open platforms to taking more responsibility for what's on their platform. This is something that I wish we did more of sooner, but I'm happy we're doing what we're doing now.
I want to ask you one more question about responsibility. You partnered with the NAACP to combat racial discrimination on your platform after African-American users posted about their experiences under the hashtag Airbnb while black. What have you changed and how can non-white users of Airbnb be confident in your service going forward?
So a handful of years ago, we were receiving complaints about people who were trying to book Airbnbs and they felt they were discriminated against. Discrimination on our platform is something we do not stand for. It is in opposition to our core beliefs. Our core belief is that we want to help bring people together and make them feel like they can belong in communities all over the world. Discrimination is an obstacle to belonging. So the first thing we did is we actually asked every single member of our platform, when they signed up, to attest that they will not actually discriminate against other users. You think this would have been a low bar, except we got thousands of very angry emails, and thousands of people decided to delete their account because they didn't even agree with that basic premise. Well, we'd rather know now. And so that was the first thing we did. The next thing we did is we created essentially the equivalent of a hotline. And so if people felt discriminated against, they could call this hotline and we'd have an agent, somebody pick up the phone and work to find them a place that is suitable. So it was really just a hotline where they could get a fast track of service. And then we worked with a series of civil rights groups, including the NAACP. We hired Laura Murphy. She works for the ACLU. And we developed a multi-year roadmap to basically develop a number of solutions to try to reduce bias and discrimination on our platform, including, for example, the removal of a guest photo when they're messaging a host and a variety of other solutions. And we're doing a lot of different tests to try to remove discrimination for a platform. But I don't want to say that, like, we're going to end discrimination. We're just hopefully going to make the world inside of Airbnb a little bit more inclusive than the world outside of Airbnb. And we're never going to stop until we actually get much closer to what our vision actually is.
Brian Chesky, your company is in, if I've got this right, 220 countries and regions, over 100,000 cities. What has been the hardest market for you to get into?
I guess every market has its own challenges, but having done business in countries in South America, in Middle East, all over Asia, I am just completely surprised how similar people are around the world. And every country has unique challenges. We just added a right-to-left language so we could have countries that actually have language right-to-left work on Airbnb. That didn't exist for a little while, and a lot of internet companies do not allow that kind of support. Cuba is one of my most proud achievements as far as international expansion. That was an extremely difficult market. But, you know, at the end of the day, what surprised me, again, isn't how different these countries are, other than like things like payments and language. It's actually inherently how similar everyone is.
I want to finally ask you just a couple of questions about you. You've joined Warren Buffett's giving pledge, pledging to give away most of your wealth. What do you think about your fellow billionaire Jeff Bezos of Amazon not doing that? He's the one of the only ones at the very top of the billionaire list who hasn't.
Well, I mean, I actually spoke to Warren Buffett when I was considering joining the Giving Pledge. Warren Buffett for decades did not pledge what he would do with his wealth. And I think he had told me, if I remember correctly, that literally for years people were kind of wondering why he wasn't giving away his wealth. And then I think he pledged to give away the vast majority, if not all of his wealth, to, for example, the Gates Foundation. The reason I say that story is I don't want to presume to know what Jeff's plans are. And if he has some really big and imminent announcements, kind of the way Warren did, and we could have criticized Warren when he was also in his 50s, but he turned out to be very generous. So it's not best for me to comment on somebody, especially when they haven't even told us what their plans are, and maybe he actually does intend to be very generous. What I will say, though, because I can speak for myself, is this. I was in my mid-30s, so I still am, when I was thinking of joining the pledge. I wasn't prepared to figure out what I would do with all that money, who I'd give it to, and what my issues would be. And so I wasn't sure to join the pledge. And when I was speaking to Warren Buffett, the thing that inspired me was the idea that maybe I can inspire entrepreneurs after me, that tech is an industry that provides great fortune for certain people. And I'm just like a pretty regular guy. I mean, my parents are social workers. I never thought I'd be in an interview like this. I never thought I would be wrestling with these kinds of things. Like, what do you do with your wealth? I wanted to really make sure that we could lead by example for a new generation of entrepreneurs, for them to know that we could give back to society because society are the ones that allow us to exist and operate, and that we could run companies that are a little bit different, that, you know, we could really meet the unique needs and challenges of society today.
In a position of your wealth and power, do you feel called to get involved in politics in any way?
Yeah, all the time. And I have to, you know, you could literally spend your whole day speaking on issues. I've decided that the issues that we're going to focus on are issues related to our mission. So we don't usually speak about a range of political issues. But if there is a political issue that is, you know, in opposition to what we believe in at Airbnb and what our mission is, then we'll speak out. And the example would be when President Trump first came into office, one of his very first executive offers was a travel ban. And I think he banned travel from, I think it was like 7 countries. Well, this, of course, a travel ban, when the majority of our business historically has been between people crossing borders between countries, is against kind of the entire premise of Airbnb. And so not only do we speak out, we spent nearly $4 million on a Super Bowl commercial, which, you know, I was a little bit nervous about doing, but I'm glad we did, just reaffirming our values. And so we do speak out, but we are very, very selective about the issues. And there's specifically issues around travel, inclusion, belonging, diversity, issues of that sort.
So you won't be making an endorsement in the 2020 presidential race?
I've never made public endorsements or presidents, and I probably won't begin that in this cycle.
I want to ask you one more question. I'm sure you travel a lot for work yourself. Do you always stay in an Airbnb when you do?
I almost always stay in Airbnb. And what I would say is I would be naive to not stay in my competitor's products.
Uh-huh.
Because if I don't stay in my competitor's products, how do I know where we're falling short of the other choices our customers have? So I usually stay in Airbnbs, but occasionally I'll book products on other websites. I'll stay in like more larger chain hotels and just get a baseline. But the vast majority of my travel is in Airbnbs. And I think the reason is because I love homes. That's why I live in one. I think that's why a lot of people live in homes. And you want to just feel like your home even when you're not in the city you live in.
So I won't ask you for the one, but what is one of the best Airbnbs you've ever stayed in?
A few years ago, I stayed in a treehouse in Burlingame, California. It's just completely crazy, the idea that you could sleep in a treehouse. We have over 1,000 treehouses on Airbnb, and there's something incredibly whimsical about a treehouse. I guess it taps into your inner child. I remember staying in this treehouse, and it was raining at night, and you could hear the rain kind of brushing against the leaves and the side of the house. And I just thought, my God, this is just an incredible getaway. It's like an escape.
Well, Brian Chesky, co-founder and CEO of Airbnb, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congress is weighing in on compensating college athletes. The Senate held its first ever hearing on it this week, and some lawmakers pressed the NCAA to do something before there are scattershot laws from states. Here's the Democrat Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut.
The NCAA is late to this game. The present state of college sports is exploitive.
Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, we know California passed a law last year that gives broad endorsement rights to players. Other states considering similar bills. Is that why Congress is getting involved?
Yes, yes, that's precisely why. And the NCAA is more or less open to it, because if there are 25 laws, if there is a patchwork of laws, then there is a question as to what the rules of the organization can be. And in life other than sports, when California makes a law, it's very important. And often they could get industry to adhere to its laws just because it's the biggest state and has the most customers. And that's also true with the NCAA, the most colleges, the most college students, the biggest population. So the NCAA doesn't want 25, and that's how many states are considering bills right now, 25 different laws. They don't want some schools to be in a state with no law allowing students to get paid. They're very worried that could lead to a competitive imbalance. But they also are, I think, quite worried that California would lead the way on this, because they have one of the most generous or liberal proposals in terms of what the student athletes could get.
Well, in fact, some lawmakers were complaining, you know, all athletes will go to California, you know, if that's where they know they can get it. And I'm learning about something called the NIL. This is names, images, and likenesses. This is where, you know, they get these rights to have some compensation for those things. So what is the NCAA doing in response?
Well, they were reluctant to ever give or allow their athletes to get any money, even the cost. I mean, for years, the athletes weren't even getting the full cost of going to school. They'd get their scholarships and their tuition paid for, but there are other costs of living. And this is why some student athletes talked about, you know, going hungry or having to stretch the bucks to buy a pizza. What the NCAA is realizing is that the boat has sailed on some form of compensation, and they just don't want it to sail so far that they can't see it from the harbor. They don't want to get the compensation ball rolling so out in front of them that they have no way to retain what essentially is a cartel of free labor. This one small carve out for a way the labor can be paid, that's something that they're acquiescing to right now.
Well, just to be clear, so when everybody's pushing the NCAA to do something, if they do something, does that, you know, trump the California law? I mean, how does that work?
Right. Under law, a national law, this is just like other statutes, a national law would have controlling power over state laws.
Right.
And the other thing, and the other important thing to know about all of this is the NCAA is trying to hold on to its extremely lucrative business. But I don't see any experts saying this is a final step.
Yeah.
And the NCAA worries, the old camel nose in the tent and all that. The NCAA worries that this will destroy what they call amateurism. But the advocates of college athletes don't worry about that. I think they see it as inevitable that this billion-dollar enterprise will have to give something more than crumbs to the people who fuel it.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
Well, it is time now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Joining us today is Ann Litt, a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, and now program director of music there at KCRW. And you are also hosting Morning Becomes Eclectic, the flagship show, at least for the moment.
I am indeed. There's a lot going on out here.
But you still have time for us.
Jeremy, I always have time for you.
Okay,
here and now.
Awesome. Well,
you heard it here.
Let's get to some of the music that you wanted us to hear today. Starting with the London group Frank Moody, this is called Skin on Skin.
I'm done with trying to play it cool. We can make it up as we go along. A little skin on skin, toe to toe. We can make it up as we go along. 'Cause we got chemistry.
So I have to say that Frank Moody shows up on my Spotify all the time, and I love Frank Moody, but tell us more. I don't know anything about Frank Moody.
Well, I think they see themselves as sort of a collective. There was really started by a duo of guys, and there's a very close-knit London rave scene, warehouse scene. And these guys bought a warehouse and started doing gigs and creating, as they say, chaos. And it's a very DIY thing.
DIY sound design is what they say on their Facebook page. They use salt shakers and mugs, dripping radiators.
Yes.
The sound of someone zipping their flies.
Yes, that's all. You find all of that. And, you know, as you heard, it's kind of a dance thing. You
right.
think of Jamiroquai and bands like Daft Punk in there, too. But it's just, they are a party. And now they're going on tour, so they will be a mobile party.
All right, well, the next one that you brought us, Anne, is another British artist. This is Steve Spacek. This is called Rawl Arena.
Isn't this great? Well, check this out. Steve Spacek made this entire album, it's called Houses, entirely on his phone and his iPad.
Wow, that is amazing. That's all done on an iPhone and iPad.
Yes, I think that's the way a lot of songwriters are doing things these days. But Steve Spacek really has gone back to his roots on this. And I read an interview with him where he said, you know, four on the floor, house music is sort of where he's most comfortable, and he wanted to make an album in a completely different way than he'd ever done before. And so he went and made kind of, back to house music and techno, an album entirely on his iPhone and his iPad. How cool is that?
That's amazing. Who is he? Who is Steve Spacek?
Well, you know, he's a UK singer and producer, and he's one of these guys who flies under this certain radar, as close to popular, I guess, as he's gotten, is in 2000, his band called Spacek had this underground hit with a song called Eve, which got remixed by J Dilla. It was sampled by The Roots. So if you're a fan of artists like J Dilla and The Roots, he's also worked with Raphael Sadiq and Q-Tip and Common, and yet he's largely unknown except to really kind of hardcore electronic music fans.
Okay, well, the next one that you brought us, also British, I'm sensing a theme here, is Lapsley.
Yes.
The song is the word woman, but there is an X instead of an A in it. Let's listen.
Back in a minute, it's just 5 years older. I wonder what it say to her. I question where I want to be. I stop judging her. I tell her who I want to be. I'll
tell us about this one.
Well, Lapsley, who, as you mentioned, is from the UK, she's an interesting one. She's only 23 years old, but she's sort of inspiring this new generation of electronically minded songwriters. And in fact, Billie Eilish has name checked her as an influencer of her sound. And the funny thing is, when she started as a teenager, she went out touring around the world. But by, you know, age 20, 21, she felt completely burned out. So she took a year off before she actually made this record. And I interviewed her recently, and I asked her what she did in that year off. And she actually volunteered with teenagers. She trained as a doula, a birth doula.
Wow.
She said she did a lot of swimming. And there's sort of a water theme running through this album. And one of the things she said that really inspired this album was a community chorus, a choir she joined called the Mixed Up Chorus. It's people who just love to sing. And she really wanted to get over some performance anxiety and doubts about herself as a songwriter. And she loved joining this chorus. So I think sort of being fully charged back up, she was ready to go back into the studio and kind of overcome a lot of the self-doubt she had as a teenager.
All right, well, the last one that you have brought us today is Lola Young. This is called Third of Jan.
I like the taste of your tongue when I forget that I'm young or that I'm supposed to be. I wonder, did he notice the rest of me? Let's fly somewhere cold. And no one will know. And no one will care.
Got a little bit of an Amy Winehouse sound to her.
Well, it's funny that you say that because she actually went to a performing school in London called the Brit School of the Arts. And Amy Winehouse was a graduate of that school, as was Adele, FKA Twigs. And all of those artists, Amy Winehouse, I mean, the first thing you think about when you think about them is just their rich, rich voices. One more item about Lola Young is she's quite young, and she actually started writing music at age 11. And this song is called Third of Jan. And she said she wrote this song the day before her birthday. And we should post the video, because in the video, she's singing and going through her routine. She gets very nervous going on stage, and she sings through her routine of getting prepared to do a show.
All right, well, Anne, while I have you here, I'm going to play you a song, which I'm sure you've already heard because you're way ahead of me on all this stuff. But this is the new one from Christine and the Queens. We're going to cross the English Channel now from Britain to France. This is Christine and the Queens, the French artist. She's just come out with a new single called People I've Been Sad.
You
You know, she's got such a nice sound, and she's such an interesting person. I know that you've interviewed her, and I've interviewed her as well.
The thing I love about her is her honesty. And one of the things she and I talked about was about modeling for other young women and making them feel strong and feel that it's okay to be whoever they are. And the thing I love about this song, People, I've Been Sad, is, you know, you can also feel the way you need to feel. What about you, Jeremy?
I mean, the thing that I find very interesting about her is that the song that she is maybe most famous for came out several years ago called Tilted. She described when I saw her in concert that that was about her when she came out as pansexual, that she was a little tilted, which when I heard the song before knowing that, I didn't realize that that's what that was about. But she's a very deep and interesting person. We will post all of these at hereandnow.org. We're also on Spotify, NPR Here and Now, and we're on Apple Music. Ann Litt, DJ and music director at KCRW, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
You know the feeling, you know the feeling.
Americans are divided on lots of issues, but a new survey from Public Agenda and USA Today shows that people agree across partisan lines that the U.S. healthcare system needs fixing. 92% of respondents say changes are needed, with a majority of Republicans and Democrats interested in seeing major changes or a complete overhaul.
You know, we have the most expensive healthcare in the world in America.
Hospitals and doctors and pharmaceutical companies are more interested in the bottom line than how it's going to benefit people.
We need to fix the system. It's the system that's broken. It's not the people.
That's Kelly Schmidt, before her Celeste Smith and Michael Weidman, three of the people who took part in that survey. Christine Herman of Side Effects Public Media and America Amplified spoke to them and other participants and has this report.
I connected with people all across the political spectrum who were eager to share their stories. People like 51-year-old Celeste Smith, a Republican in Bella Vista, Arkansas. She was diagnosed with thyroid cancer in 2014. Even with insurance and paying some costs up front, the surgery she needed left her on the hook for $6,000.
Which I didn't have. And it was very, very difficult for us to try and negotiate making payments to the hospital.
Smith ended up getting sued by a collection agency.
I'm trying to recover from, you know, having this cancer surgery and getting it removed and the subsequent meds and tests that I have to get done. We did wind up, you know, making a deal with them to pay a smaller amount, which they agreed to. But it took having my credit essentially ruined for a couple of years.
In Faribault, Minnesota, Kelly Schmid can relate. She's 48 and politically independent. She has a condition that has required numerous surgeries to remove cysts and bone spurs. In her 30s, her health got worse.
My deductible at that time in 2004 was $1,150. And so we maxed that out probably, I think, at the end of January, beginning of February. I mean, that's 1 month into the year. And this year in 2020, my deductible is $11,500, and we are going to hit that max by the end of next month. The deductibles go up every year. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. They just go up.
Schmidt is frustrated with the rising rates and the fact that it's often impossible to know what a procedure is going to cost up front. 50-year-old Gary Pritchett, a Republican, is from Griffin, Georgia. While he's happy with the quality of health care he receives and generally opposes big government, he says he would support efforts to promote price transparency.
I wouldn't give you a blank check for anything else. I mean, that's almost unacceptable. To me, there's no other industry that can get away with that.
And on that point, Pritchett and 25-year-old Caitlin Strine agree. She's a Democrat in Hot Springs, Arkansas. She has a rare genetic condition that has left her disabled. Strine says she's so afraid of high medical bills that she waits until the last minute to seek care.
I was diagnosed with brain swelling in 2012, and I didn't actually get diagnosed with a brain tumor
until 2015, and I didn't get it removed until 2017 because I knew that there was going to be no way I could pay for it. It actually caused some cognitive issues that I'm still dealing with and will deal with for the rest of my life.
The people I spoke with place blame in different places: doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, even politicians. But the survey shows Republicans and Democrats actually have similar goals for the healthcare system. More than 9 out of 10 people say it's important to make healthcare more affordable for ordinary Americans and to lower the cost of prescription drugs. The survey also finds wide agreement that people with pre-existing conditions should be able to get coverage, that the elderly and disabled should have long-term care, and that hospitals should be more transparent about pricing.
And they also have very relatively similar ideas on how it should go about doing that.
Chris Jackson is with the research firm Ipsos, which conducted the survey with Public Agenda and USA Today. The results show nearly half of all Americans, including almost 40% of Republicans, say they'd be likely to support a new public federal health insurance program that people could buy into on a sliding scale.
The commonality only really starts to break down when you talk about who's going to pay for things. And that's still sort of the point of division.
Republican Celeste Smith says she'd be willing to pay higher taxes to create a better healthcare system.
If I knew for sure, you know, for sure that they were going to be taking care of us the way they say they're going to take care of us.
But independent Kelly Schmid says she opposes tax increases and feels the government just needs to do a better job prioritizing spending.
There's enough money in that budget to help fix what we need to be fixed. Instead of giving it to everybody else in every different nation, fix the nation that needs to be fixed first, and that's us.
Despite these differences of opinion, Chris Jackson says the survey findings suggest there's more common ground on this issue than we're often led to believe. And if we focus on that, it could be the start of a productive dialogue about how to create a healthcare system that works for all Americans. For Here and Now, I'm Christine Herman.
And Christine's story comes to us from America Amplified, a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
Democratic frontrunner Bernie Sanders is looking to extend his lead after his win in New Hampshire. Former Chief of Staff John Kelly comes to the defense of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman after President Trump says the military may discipline him. That and more in our Politics Week in Review, next time, Here and Now.